This is McGuire on the Wire, brought to you by McGuire Sponsel. We are a national consulting firm aiming to provide facts, advice, and updates on the ever-changing world of tax law. This podcast will give you base-level information as well as high-level thought leadership on how to navigate these technical disciplines. At McGuire Sponsel, we provide unique services to our clients using an old-school, hands-on approach that is deeply respected within the CPA industry. Now stick around and listen to one of our experts. We're glad you're here.
Now, I've been doing this type of work for about 20 years now, and so one of the things I wanted to talk about today is just some of the common misconceptions we see as it relates to depreciation and other parts of the tax code related as related areas. And this gets a little bit confusing because we run into this all the time, often with people that think they are experts in this area. We'll meet with CPA firms that will have some issues on their depreciation schedules or other things. And unfortunately, the problem with depreciation is it's one of the areas that has the biggest effects on someone's tax liability at the end of the year. But often with a lot of businesses, it's one of the areas that gets the least amount of effort put in behind it. So today we wanted to just take a few minutes to talk about some of the common misconceptions. Now, on our website, we're going to be going into each one of these in more detail over the next few months to really dig into some of these areas and explain them in greater detail. Now, obviously, the first one that always comes up is depreciation doesn't matter. It's just a timing issue. And of course, we can go into many reasons why that's not true, but obviously, a dollar in the hand is worth more than one in the future. And a great way to look at this is if I am just sitting there as a standard taxpayer and I go to my accountant or my financial planner at the end of the year and say, hey, great news, I got a big refund. Everyone would expect my financial planner to tell me, that's not great news. If you got a refund at the end of the year, that meant the IRS was holding on to your money all year long and you didn't have that to work with. Now, any type of depreciation analysis is the same thing. By accelerating deductions now, we can take advantage of that money. And we might not be talking about 1 year, we might be talking about the difference between getting it today versus the IRS holding on to it over 40 years. So that's just one example of why that common misconception that, hey, it's just a timing thing, don't worry about it. Now, that's just one example of where we see things, but that's more just on the typical planning nature. The rest of the things we're going to talk about today are more actual mistakes that are often made. Now, the first one we want to talk about is the use of 27 and a half year depreciation. Now, anyone that deals in any type of tax format knows that 27 and a half years is used for the depreciation of residential properties. So under the Modified Accelerated Cost Recovery System, or MACRS, real estate is depreciated over 39 years, and that's for non-residential. Now, residential real estate has a preferential treatment of 27 and a half years. Now, the question that we often see is, well, okay, number one, how do we split a building? And the answer is you don't. And often we will go in and look at a fixed asset listing and see one building listed with a portion of the building on 39 years and a portion of the building on 27 and a half years. And that's the incorrect way of utilizing it. Now, under Section 168 is where we see all the definitions in the tax code dealing with this. And specifically what it says is if more than 80% of the rent is being derived from residential sources. And when they define residential, they say long-term residential rental. And I'll get into that a little bit in a minute. But if more than 80% is being derived from long-term residential rental, then the entire building is considered residential. If, however, more than 20% is being derived from non-long-term residential, then the entire building is not considered residential rental. So if we take a mixed-use building, if 75% of the revenue for that building is coming from residential and 25% is coming from commercial, then that's a commercial building and would be depreciated over 39 years. Now, conversely, if you have 90% coming from residential and only 10% coming from your commercial, then that's considered a residential building. Now, that's going to be even more important if we end up seeing qualified improvement property being eligible for bonus depreciation as it's supposed to be under the new tax law. Now, as we've discussed in the past on this podcast and in other areas, right now there's some questions about qualified improvement property. Because the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was written relatively quickly, they made some mistakes when drafting it. But let's just assume for argument's sake that they've fixed this by the time you're listening to this podcast. Qualified improvement property is non-structural improvements put into a building after the building's originally placed in service, but only for non-residential property. Now that means if a mixed-use building gets 21% of its revenue from non-residential sources, that building is now a non-residential building. That means any of those interior improvements would be qualified improvement property and potentially eligible for bonus if they fix that error in the tax code. So that's going to be a pretty important area for people to pay attention to as they move forward. Now, the other thing I wanted to just quickly mention is what is considered long-term residential. There's no real cut and dry definition, but we can go back through and look at some older definitions. Typically, what the IRS has gone off in the past, if more than half the units are used for transient basis, it's not considered long-term residential. And they consider long-term residential basically about 30 days. So what they actually say is if for more than one half of the days that a unit is occupied in a rental basis during the taxpayer's taxable year, it is occupied by a tenant or series of tenants, each of whom which occupies the unit for less than 30 days, it's considered transient. In other words, if you live in the unit for more than 30 days, it's considered non-transient, and it can qualify for the long-term residential. So that's just a little bit on that 27 and a half years. The key thing is you don't want to split buildings. It's either 27 and a half or it's a 39-year building. You don't see them split down the line. Now, the next thing I wanted to briefly mention is the use of ADS. We often see this as an error that's made on a lot of tax returns as well. For those that don't know, right now under makers, you have the GDS, which is what we see most of the time. That's where you get bonus depreciation. That's where you get 200% declining balance on personal property, 150% on land improvements, and straight line on real property. Now, there's the alternative depreciation system, or ADS, which slows down a lot of those lives and moves to more of a straight line. Now, there are certain areas where people understand they have to use those. That's for property predominantly used outside of the United States or some other areas. Where we see most of the time people missing this is property that's predominantly leased to tax-exempt entities. And specifically, people look at that and they say, tax-exempt entities, that's okay, that's charities, that's churches, things like that. What a lot of people miss out on is that actually includes governments. And that's where we see the biggest mistake, is that the definition for tax exempt for this portion includes government agencies, anybody that's part of the U.S. government, any state or political subdivision thereof. So if you have a building that is predominantly leased to, for example, the federal government, or is used as a building that's leased to the state for different state organizations, that would be required to be depreciated under the ADS class life, which means that the big problem there is you miss out on bonus depreciation. Now, that was never really that big an issue in the past, but it's going to become a bigger issue moving forward now that bonus depreciation is eligible on used property. When we have investors that are going out and looking at buildings, they're going to have to consider if that building is currently leased to the government, they might purchase a building and have to depreciate the building over an ADS class life, which means they don't get that bonus depreciation on the purchase. And that would make a big difference when they're purchasing a building in the time of 100% bonus depreciation. Now, that's one other area. The next area we want to just briefly mention is land preparation cost. This is another area we see people mess up all the time. Land preparation cost, according to the IRS, anything used to bring land to a buildable level is considered a land cost. So, for example, if I go in and I buy some swampy land that is below grade and it's not really buildable, it's wet. We see this a lot in Florida or other areas, or New Jersey or other areas that have a lot of swamp land. And the builder needs to bring in land or dirt to fill that up and level it off. To get that building up, that land up to a buildable grade, that is all land preparation cost. And according to the IRS, that is increasing the basis of the land. So a lot of that initial cost to get that up to level, The other thing that we see there is clearing and grubbing of trees. So if I buy a plot of land that was a forest and I want to build a apartment complex on it, and I have to take out a whole bunch of trees and other areas in order to get that to a buildable lot, that's all going to be a land preparation cost. So it's important for us to look at those type of things and know if we need to add that to the land. Now, there's certain things that we can do. For example, certain excavation costs. Well, if the excavation is to bring that to a buildable grade, that goes on the land cost. But if the excavation is underneath the building or underneath the parking lot, those are going to go on the lives of the assets that go above it. So we can look at those and potentially not have to put all of that into a land cost, and it's something that you really need to talk to a professional advisor about. Now, the key thing I do want to point out here is because of this, we should never see some of these land preparation costs on a purchased building. And often we see people do a cost-seg study on a purchased building, and we will see things like clearing and grubbing of trees as a land improvement value with a 15-year class life. And there are two things that are wrong with that. Number one, there is no way for the purchaser to know if that lot, when it was originally built out 30 years prior, had trees on it to remove. Number two, that would be a land value, not a land preparation, or not a land improvement value. So the cost segregation professional, by doing that, number one, they're making up things that don't exist. But number two, potentially are arguing that the land value should be increased and creating an exposure there for the taxpayer. So we do want people to pay attention to land preparation costs moving forward. Now, the other two areas that I want to talk just briefly about is the biggest one is demolition of structures. This does not change under the new tax law. This did not change under the tangible property regs. This is an area that has been pretty consistent with the IRS in recent years, and we don't see this messed up that much, but it is something I just wanted to cover, is that the demolition, if you buy a plot of land with a building on it, and you have to tear down a building in order to build a new building, the tearing down of that building and the remaining basis of that building are added to the basis of land. This did not change under the tangible property regs. A lot of people thought when we started being able to dispose of portions of buildings or other things like that, that we could then write off structures when they were demolished. And that is not the case. Now, there are some exceptions to that in the cases where potentially the building's condemned and no one was expecting it and it's retired or something else, but those are very, very rare and it's not something we see very often. But in general, if you tear down a building, it's added to the basis of the land. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important specifically when it comes to renovations. We have to be very careful when we see some renovations that are listed as renovations that the taxpayer doesn't tear down too much of the building and actually potentially create an area where they're not really renovating. They're now building a new construction and potentially increasing the value of that land. So it's something we just need to watch those tests for to make sure that we don't change the value of the land in the process. Now, the last thing I want to just briefly talk about, and there are some other areas, and we will get into some more areas where there's some confusion, but the last thing I want to get into is decorative metal or exterior panels. And this is something we've actually been seeing quite a bit in recent years, is these metal panels have different names. The most common one that we see is ACM, or aluminum composite material panels. And the best way to think about this is just think about driving down the highway. Next time you're driving down by all the different car dealerships, just drive past them. And a lot of the renovated car dealership now have these shiny metal panels that are typically rectangular in nature, and they look like they're just tacked onto the outside of the building. Those are often known as ACM panels. Now, the question is, are those ACM panels decorative in nature and almost like a sign or something that's just really advertising the business? Or are they part of the structure of the building? And it's something that we really need to look at on a case-by-case basis. Now, especially with new construction, often those ACM panels actually do have some structural requirements. They tend to be waterproofing, tend to have insulation in them. They tend to be built into the storefront or the windows on the building, where if you remove those panels, the windows don't have anything to hold on to. And we need to look at actually the structural plans and see how they're attached. Another example of this is we recently looked at a building that was just the studs. Then there was plywood sheathing, just like you would have on a house. And then a Tyvek wrap, which is just the wrap that goes around the outside of buildings. And then on top of that, they just screwed in the ACM panels. So the ACM panels were the entire weatherproofing to keep the wind and the rain off of that Tyvek sheeting. Now, in that case, that's pretty obvious that that then becomes a structural member of the building and you can't remove it. Now, there are times that we are seeing renovations where those metal panels are just put on with some type of Z-clip or some other type of clip and can be removed, and they are decorative in nature. But it is something that really needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis, and there is no blanket, yes, these are personal property, or no, they're not personal property. We really have to be very careful about that. And that's an area we've seen a lot of confusion on and a lot of people trying to be aggressive with those panels and saying they are all personal property, and that's not always the case. But also, we don't want to say it's always the case that they're always real property. It really needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. Now, as I mentioned, there's a number of other issues that we need to talk about. That could be anything from the use of qualified leasehold improvements prior to the new tax law. It could be whether or not cost segregation is necessary after the tangible property regulations and now after this new tax law. And there are a number of these different areas. And we'd be happy if you have any examples of this, please let us know, and we'll be happy to cover them in future podcasts and also future articles. But we just want to point out that depreciation is an area where there is a lot of still confusion, and even people that have been doing this for many years still see areas where people have messed these things up in the past. So we want to just bring some light to some of these areas and make sure that we're all educated as to the proper way of handling all these different areas. I appreciate you logging on. As always, please contact us if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to McGuire on the Wire. Have a question from today's episode or interested in our team covering another topic? Reach out to us at McGuireOnTheWire@McGuireSponsel.com.